This is Sam Sebrin from Athens, and you are listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM and WGXC.org.
Hi, this is Michael Wilde inviting you to Mostly Singles, and if you like what you're hearing, you'll love this show. Rarefied music, premieres, and guests. It's different every time. And a podcast, too. Go to WGXC.org. Mostly Singles, every fourth Tuesday at 8 to 10 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM.
La despensa de alimentos de Catskill está localizada en la parroquia de la Iglesia de St. Luke en Catskill, en la calle William, número 50. La despensa está abierta todos los viernes de la 1 hasta las 4 de la tarde. La comida sana es un derecho. Para más información, bienvenidos a todos a venir, llamar por teléfono a 551-299-2456, mirar la página web catskillfoodpantry.org o conectar con nosotros en Facebook en Catskill Food Pantry.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Philip Grant of Troy, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You, too, can become a monthly supporter by going to WGXC.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Come on. Good evening, listeners, and happy Election Day. This is the Capital District Democratic Socialist Good Time Hour. You're listening either on WGXC ACRA 90.7 on your FM dial or on wavefarm.org. The show broadcasts on the first Tuesday of every month, and tonight we're broadcasting live, me from my office in Greenville and Bill live from Main Street in Catskill. I'm Casey, your host, along with my co-host Bill, who shamelessly and pretentiously goes by Poche Noir.
Bonsoir, comrades. Tonight being November 4th, besides being Election Day, it is the 14th day of the month of Brumaire in the year 234, the French Republican calendar. The 14th of Brumaire is represented by the endive, which makes a nutritious but bitter salad. My mom used to make an endive salad, which I was...
I love an endive salad.
Okay. I picked up some endives today just because of that.
They're amazing. If you've ever made larb, which is a Lao dish, you use like an endive as the vessel with which you eat the larb. It's incredible.
Okay.
Anyway.
Larb? L-A-R-B?
L-A-R-B, yep.
Okay. Okay. But the month of Brumaire is very special for people who think about Marx, as I do. In 1852, Marx published his work, The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. It's all about the revolution of 1848 in France, which established the French Second Republic, which, to Marx's chagrin, elected the lame and somewhat vicious Louis Napoleon as president of the Second Republic. Who then quickly on performed a coup d'etat. In the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, Marx explains how the mediocrity of Napoleon Bonaparte navigated class conflict between the French working class and the French bosses to end up ruling France through that coup d'etat and the establishment of the French Second Empire. So I'm going to give you the opening line of...
Whoa.
I know. I'm sorry, listeners. And I'm sorry, Casey. So let me give you a quote from the opening lines. Hegel remarks somewhere that all great events and characters of world history recur, so to speak, twice. He forgot to add, the first time is tragedy, the second is farce. Sometimes as a mistranslation, they say recur to occur, but it must be recur for the sentence to make any sense because there has to be three events. One is the first event. Second is the first recurrence, which is the tragedy. And third is the second recurrence, which is the farce. So, over to you, Casey.
I'm so lost, but clearly this is our super serious election day show. Here is the necessary litany, since this is obviously a very opinionated show, or maybe not obvious if you're a first-time listener, but if you've listened before, you know that. The remarks made in this program are our very own and not of those of WGXC, nor are they officially of the Democratic Socialists of America. Bill and I are just a couple of socialists and members of the DSA speaking our minds.
Okay. And if you want to make your own opinions known, then you may consider joining the Democratic Socialists of America. The only thing asked for by DSA is a recognition that the unfair world in which we live in is in need of some real help, and you have to have a desire to do something about it. You do not have to be a strict Marxist like me. So let's go to another musical break.
Let's. Oh, and the first one, who we listened to, it was D'Angelo, A Thousand Deaths, R.I.P.
Yes, R.I.P. D'Angelo.
Yeah, what a great song. Now over to Joni.
Okay, go for it, Casey. Casey, you there?
I am here.
Good.
Very nice. That was In France, the Kiss on Main Street, Joni Mitchell. So, New York. About to elect Zoran, knock on wood.
Oh my God, I'm so happy. I am so happy that that Zoran is seems to be coasting to victory. There's the polls close at 9, but it seems that way.
Yeah, I haven't looked at anything yet because I've been burned in the past.
I know. We've all been burned in the past. But you know what? Since I have been looking, I have been having able to get access to New York One.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been kind of enjoying their coverage because they have a lot of local politicians in New York. And some of them are so reactionary and crazy, and they just can't deal with Zoran.
You know who's reactionary and crazy, who I love, is Curtis.
You know, but Zoran himself said that he actually has a lot of respect for Curtis. I think he's going to do very well tonight, which is
obviously I want Zoran to win massively, but I also would love Cuomo to lose to him as well, because I think that would just be such a joy.
I just don't ever want to see Andrew Cuomo ever again.
Especially
the way he trots out his two daughters.
Yeah, it's so just gross. It's so gross.
I hear that his promotional t-shirts are all wife beaters.
Oh, Bill, I have your Zoran shirt, by the way.
Don't worry. All right. I'll wear that.
Oh, you know what? Your joke just registered in my brain, but I remembered that I have your shirt before registered the joke.
Okay. So let's get to our next segment. This is a very special segment.
Yes. So we have a special guest tonight, even though this is not a live guest. We are going to broadcast the remarks of the Jacobin magazine contributor, Catalyst Magazine, editor and NYU professor Vivek Chibber. Is that how you pronounce their last name, Chibber?
On his podcast, people call him Vivek.
Vivek, okay. Yes. See? Vivek Chibber. Tell us more about it, Bill.
Well, it was part of his Confronting Capitalism podcast, and it's about the left, instead of building on what they have, actually having to start over. And he does a very, very good job of it. So I would just like to get to it if we could.
Let's do it. Lock in, folks.
It's about a half hour long. And as I, you know, this is the super serious edition of this show. All right?
Absolutely.
All right. Here we go, folks.
Vivek Chibber.
All right.
We got permission to play this, by the way.
Oh, yes, we did. From himself.
It's always remarkable when a magazine in today's climate manages to survive as long as Jacobin has. But for a magazine of the left to survive and to grow and to flourish the way it has, and to actually get better over time the way it has, I think it's no exaggeration to say that Jacobin is the most important magazine of the left in the English language today, anywhere. And it's really quite an honor to see so many people here supporting it, and an honor to be useful to Bhaskar and Rumike Forbes, this dynamic duo that's been driving the project forward for so long. They really are generational talents, these two, and I would really like to honor them publicly right now. Well, Jacobin got going about 15 years ago. It's a very different time right now than when it started. When Jacobin started, there was not much of a hint of what was coming, the political storm that was coming in the United States and really in much of the world. It was really at that time that you saw the first glimmerings with the Occupy movement and the Arab Spring. And cascading on top of that, of course, the explosive moment was the Bernie Sanders campaign. And these last 15 years, it's been one development after another, all of which has given rise to some kind of shift back towards a left that had seemed, at the very least, dormant for the longest time, but perhaps even something deeper. As we saw these developments unfolding over time, what became clear, at least to most of us on the left, was there was a dual operation that was underway, the first component of which was that for the first time since the late 1970s, early 1980s, we could genuinely say that the reigning model of accumulation, which was known as neoliberalism, was actually in a crisis. This was remarkable. Just 5 or 8 years prior to that, it had seemed as if it was an unshakable force of nature, immovable. And Margaret Thatcher's aphorism that when it comes to the modern free market world, the proper description is TINA, there is no alternative, it really seemed appropriate, as late as 2008, 2009. But by 2016, it was clear that we were in the midst of an actual crisis that none of us would have foreseen. And there are two dimensions to this. The first, which is still underway today, was an ideological crisis, what you might call a crisis of legitimacy. Whatever else was going on, whatever else was happening, what was clear was that certainly in the advanced capitalist world, but in many, many parts of the global south as well, neoliberalism had lost all legitimacy with the general public. Now, why? Should be obvious. The same forces that brought about the Occupy movement and the same forces that have brought about this political churning in the culture brought about the delegitimation, which was the yawning, extraordinary, unbelievable inequality that had now enveloped the advanced world. We have never seen inequality like this since the early 1900s. And the second, of course, was that alongside the inequality was a slowdown in economic growth. Since the 1990s, what we have seen across the advanced world is a quite gradual but unmistakable slowing down of the economic tempo from business cycle to business cycle. The rate of accumulation has gone down, and the rate of economic growth that's attendant upon the rate of accumulation has also gone down. So what you've had is a slow growth capitalism where people, the standard of living of ordinary people has either been stagnant or declining, accompanied by an obscene concentration of wealth on top. Now, this is a story everybody knows. It is not a surprise that 35 years into this, it resulted in a tremendous loss of legitimacy and popularity within the population. This is not to say that it was ever legitimate. There is a view out there among the lumpen intelligentsia that neoliberalism was surviving because it elicited the consent of the masses. It never had the consent. What it had was a kind of grudging acceptance because the masses saw no other alternative, and most of them thought that whatever animosity, whatever hostility they had towards the social order, it was confined to them. They were the ones feeling it, but everybody else was happy. What the Occupy movement did, even though the Occupy movement didn't itself give rise to a politics, was that its explosion onto the scene made visible to everyone that they were not alone in their unhappiness, that everybody else was as well. So what was, in fact, a state of resignation to neoliberalism turned into a rejection. That was the ideological crisis. But accompanying that has been what one might call a political crisis. And that is that even though the political class, the dominant parties, center-left and center-right, even though the political class knows that this crisis is underway, they have no way of providing an alternative to it. And that's largely because their corporate masters are uninterested in an alternative. So you have this extraordinary situation where, as the Marxists at the turn of the century, last century, used to say, the old order is dying, but the new one cannot be born. That was the situation that we saw emerge with the Bernie Sanders movement. And we're still in that condition today. Now, in such a situation, you would imagine it's a God-given opportunity for a revitalization of the left. This is a moment in which the crisis within the economic regime could have been turned into a new era of mobilization of workers. And many of us had expected that that is kind of what would happen. What you'd see is a revitalization of a left after a hiatus since the 1980s. This is the project that most everybody in this room is involved in today. But I would make the argument, what we're engaged in today is not so much revitalizing the left so much as starting over. We're having to cobble together institutions where they do not exist. Not only are we having to cobble together these institutions, we are having to make intellectual, ideological, political arguments within the left that you have never had to make in 100 years. I'm going to come to that. If the challenge today is best described as us starting over, the question is, why? What is it that is impelling us to start from the very beginning again? What are the challenges in doing so, and what is the way forward as we embark on this? Well, the crisis that I've made reference to of neoliberalism had as its dual, its complement, a ongoing dismantling and crisis of the institutions that working class parties and working class organizations had built up for almost 100 years. Starting in the late 1970s, in much of the advanced world, certainly in the English-speaking countries in the Atlantic world, what you saw was a quite rapid dismantling of not only social democracy, not only the welfare state, but as we all know, the trade unions and the working class organizations that had built up this welfare state, that had fought for it, and which had sustained it over time. So on the one hand, the unions and all the organizations that orbited around them were being dismantled. At the same time, the parties that had led working class struggles for more than three quarters of a century, the socialist, social democratic, labor parties, whatever names they went by, all of those parties were getting hollowed out. They were getting hollowed out in the sense that, first of all, they had ceased to explicitly be parties of the working class. And secondly, the vertical links that they had with the class were being severed. Partly they were being severed because those links depended on union support and union organization. So as unions were dismantled, so the links went with them. But also because the parties had turned away from the historic commitments and the struggles that they had engaged in and had become essentially managerial parties. So there was this yawning gap between parties up here and the working class down at the bottom. The Democratic Party had never been a working class party, but it did have tenuous but real links to the trade union movement, and those trade unions did provide it with a kind of a cultural and political anchor within working communities. And that, by the 1990s, was also gone. So when these murmurings start up in the early 2000s, 2010s, to take up the struggle against neoliberalism, what you find yourself in is not only the crisis of the establishment, but a left that by this time does not have the anchor in the very constituency that it had been associated with and identified with for 100 years. This is, of course, instanced in the first by the absence of any kind of organized expression of resistance. But it also has a ideological and cultural expression, which is that not only is it the case that the left, such as it is, fails to organize its constituency, workers, is that identifying the constituency as central is itself called into question. By the early 2000s, what you have found is that in the intervening years, the 1980s and the 90s and the early aughts, you had now had the longest period we have seen since the 1880s of a complete absence of class struggle in the advanced world. From the 1880s onward, if you look at the record, every 25 to 30 years, there's been a wave of working class mobilizations in continental Europe, in England, and in the United States. Starting in the late 1970s with the destruction of the trade union movement in the US, but even in Europe, you have seen an unbelievable abatement of explicit union-led movements and union mobilizations. Well, the result has been that for the first time since the inception of the trade union movement, you have lost one of the main mechanisms of political education. And that has been that every generation of trade union militants, socialists, party activists, has brought in the next generation from those movements that are coming up every 25 to 30 years. And they have not had to learn it from scratch. They've been partly educated by the people who led the previous cycle of movements. There's been a cumulative process of political learning on the left. It's a very long process. But after four decades of a complete absence of struggle, that, what you might call oral tradition, was gone. Not only was it gone, politics abhors the vacuum. You still had a political discourse. You still had some kind of ideological radicalism, some kind of left-wing posturing. But for the first time, it was exclusively coming out of elite institutions, which is the universities and the nonprofits. This is why, after Occupy and after Bernie Sanders, when the left started to pick itself up again, what it found was it was not clear anymore what it means to be on the left. In the space that had been occupied by the labor movement, by the labor militants, by class struggle unionists, was now taken up by the professoriate, by the NGO university complex, by politicos, by journalists. And instead of having a direct appreciation or connection with the working class, you not only had a retreat into what we now know we call identity politics, but you had a questioning of the very foundations of the socialist project from the left. Not just the centrality of class, but of the universalism that socialists held to, of the materialism that undergirded their social analyses, of the location of capitalism as the central dilemma, the central challenge, and the central focus of left-wing organizing. All of that was gone. And all of that was gone in the name of radicalism. So it's not just that the left was organizationally and politically enfeebled, it was ideologically confused. And it continues to be today, all three of these things. This is the first left in the modern era where you have to make an argument for the primacy of class. And when you do it, you should expect to be attacked from the left. That is what neoliberalism wrought. Today's left is internal to neoliberalism still. It is in no position to challenge it because it cannot conceive of a world in which ordinary working people are the central political agent. Well, that's where we were. So what is it that the challenge has been over the past 10 years? Well, of course, it's been to try, for those of us who still see ourselves as socialists, it has been to build, not revive, but build new institutions that might connect the left to its historical constituency, which is workers. It has been to reestablish all those connections that were lost. But doing so, first of all, requires for the left that's coming out of these circles that we inhabit, it requires extricating ourselves from the miasma, the intersectional identitarian miasma that has defined radical politics for the last 15 years. And this has been one of the central missions of Jacobin. This is why it is the one indispensable organ of the left, because there's no other organ that understands that without a focus on the lives and the conditions of working people, and just to be clear, they're not all white, they're not all men. So when we talk about the working class, we are not talking about heterosexual white males. We are primarily in this country talking about people of color, women, for whom the everyday struggle for livelihood, for housing, for healthcare defines their existence. The challenge, therefore, that to which Jacobin has been committed has been to defend and advance this intellectual project. A magazine can only do so much, but it's done a lot just with this. And this is why, because of this confusion, it's not the left that's been able to take advantage of this crisis, but the far right. Because the far right understands one thing the left still hasn't, which is that if you go to people and you talk to them about their immediate economic conditions, whatever horrible discourse you're wrapping it in, if you show it to them, if you'd say to them that we are concerned with your jobs, with your welfare, with your benefits, they're going to come. The confusion of the left is mirrored by the clarity on the right. And this is why, as far as I'm concerned, we're starting over. Not just to rebuild institutions that have been decayed, that have been allowed to fall apart, but to re-achieve at least the one thing that socialists always had, which was clarity on what your constituency is, who you're trying to organize, and who you're organizing against. Well, it's been 15 years of this. It sounds bad, it is, but here's the, I think, good news. There's been an extraordinary process of political learning as well within those eddies of the left around Jacobin, but also inside the DSA and other whatever small organizations are. There has been what I, from my vantage point, see as a fairly rapid understanding that that whole intersectional culture is a political dead end, at least for the goals that progressives have traditionally had. And you see it in the gaining momentum for what is now called economic populism. Even on the left today, the idea that you should concentrate on economic demands, on everyday livelihood issues, is now finally gaining traction. And there's no better signal, there's no better sign of this than the extraordinary success of the Zoran Mamdani campaign. New York has rightly taken its place as the epicenter of the global left. That's where it belongs. I'm even seeing some grad students drawn into it. I'm even seeing some professors grudgingly acknowledge that poor people matter. Mamdani's campaign is an extraordinary vindication of the basic insight that once used to be common sense for the socialists. Get your shit together on the economic questions. You want to bring people together? You want to organize a multiracial, multicultural, working class of different cultural, sexual expressions? They are workers. What they have in common is their economic situation. Focus on that. Sanders has been pushing this point ad nauseum. Ask Sanders any question. What color is the sky today? He'll say 60% of Americans can't make ends meet except check to check. Ask Bernie Sanders, what date were you born? He'll say, well, it turns out universal health care is the only solution to blah, blah, blah. There has never been anybody as monotonically on point as Bernie Sanders. Mamdani himself embodies the transition. I have some friends who like to prod me and trigger me. So when I got really excited about the Mamdani campaign, they would send me these screenshots of old texts that he had put out or declarations, which embodied all the things I'm criticizing just 4 years ago. His maturation into what he is today is an extraordinary vindication. It kind of embodies in this weird Hegelian way the spirit, right? That his own political maturation shows that it's possible to come out of the depths of the what is called the woke radical culture and do this extraordinary achievement of coming out of nowhere. And he might very well be the next mayor of New York. Whatever challenges come, just that is a vindication, is a demonstration that there is a learning that's going on and there is hope for the future. So I would like in the rest of this talk to just now focus on the positive or at least the kinds of questions we should be asking. If you agree with me, and I suspect most of you do, that Mamdani has honed in on what is essential to the revitalization of the socialist project in the United States. I'm actually having to say this, to focus on the everyday needs of the working class. If you just humor me, that this is what's key. Then we can look at some of the challenges that we in the New York left, and I think on the global left, face, because The way in which this politics is progressing is actually more or less in line with what you see elsewhere, too. The central defining element of this new populism, this new left, or whatever you want to call it, is that it is constrained in many ways, organizationally and politically, by the same factors that I've laid out, which is that it still does not have an anchor, an organizational, cultural, and institutional anchor within the working class. So the way it's able to fight for its political advances is purely through the electoral realm. By putting out a message, and I mean, lucky for us, he's a generational talent in putting out the political message. Putting out the message, showing people that there's someone here willing to fight for you, and then hopefully fighting for the promulgation, the legislation of that agenda. But make no mistake, every single left political success over the past 6 or 8 years has been purely electoral. Past 10 years, if we start with Podemos and work our way forward. Now that has challenges, and I think those challenges are such that I think they're unwinnable. If the revitalized left now, the one left that's starting over, that's trying to understand once again the centrality of class politics, the centrality of working people, the importance of actually struggling for power rather than striking a pose. If that left continues to move forward, continues to make advances, it's going to have to look at elections as an instrument, not as an end. The reason is simple. You can win tactical battles, skirmishes through the media, through your programs, through elections. It's, I think, almost impossible to sustain it over time because the media is what it is. It is controlled by the forces who actually control the means of production. And however much you're going to reach out through social media, through YouTube, through TikTok, etc., it's going to be very hard to win that battle. Not just because their advantage in the resources they have, but messaging is a very, very imperfect science. It's not even a science. It's at best an art. You put out a message, and it's very hard to predict how it's going to be interpreted and absorbed by the people who you're putting it out to if it's done from a 30,000 feet distance. If you win these victories of the elections here, perhaps in Minneapolis, perhaps in Michigan or Maine, you must use them, in my view, as a springboard to build your anchor and sink that anchor within the class. You have to do it, first of all, through building trade unions. There has never been a sustained success on the left except through partnership with the unions. You can see why. It's not just that the unions give you power against capital. I'm saying that like it's a small thing. It is the thing. But there's also other aspects of it that people may not immediately think of. The unions is what helps build the identity of the class that you're trying to draw upon for your electoral strategies. The unions are what builds confidence that people have not just in their organizations, but in each other. The unions is what gives them the sense of being in a collective mission. A left that focuses on elections to the detriment of the unions is one that's going to sooner or later lose. And the reason is simple. Once you win elections, you're going to have the entire ruling class lined up against you. They're going to tank the economy. They're going to make sure your administration is impossible. They're going to make sure that whatever municipal bodies there are throw a wrench in the works. And if you don't have an enduring face-to-face relationship with the people who you're trying to represent, of course, they're going to sooner or later turn against you. They have to, because your election is going to be associated with a dramatic fall in the quality of governance, in the economic situation, and perhaps even in their livelihoods. If you do win the elections, it has to be just the first step towards rebuilding this. Alongside that, you have to build a machine which doesn't just do door knocking once every 2 years or once every 4 years, which doesn't just talk to the people to tell them why your candidate is better, but the machine has to live in the same neighborhoods as the people who you're trying to attract. It has to talk to them on a daily basis, because it's on the basis of that you'll articulate a program, and that program will not be communicated from 30,000 feet on high. They will see it as an expression of their own interests and their own aspirations, and they will fight for the program because it came from them. If we define electoralism as seeking power through elections, it has a very limited future for the left. We should be grateful for it right now, because right now that's where the energy is. But it has to be, in my view, seen as simply the step towards a more sustained strategy, which is to rebuild the kind of presence inside the working class that the left had for 7-8 decades in the 20th century. Secondly, at some point, you have to take the party question seriously. Right now, socialists are trying to use the Democratic Party and ballot initiatives and the independent party line the best of their ability. But at some point, you're going to have a party. Maybe not to run elections. That's virtually impossible in the United States to run as a third party. But absolutely as a way of organizing the class, in which you have cadre, in which there has to be a commitment on the part of the cadre to a political program, not just a vague gesture towards, I want to see a better world. And that party is going to have to wage national campaigns. If your goal is socialism, there's never been even a social democratic advance without a party of the working class, not just social clubs with some workers in them. And finally, I'll close with this. Just to get there, just to start this process, there is also an intellectual challenge. One of the things that the 4 decades of the neoliberal dark ages did in driving the radical left into the universities and the nonprofits, that left, the socialists within it, were in a hostile and alien environment in which they were constantly pilloried as being insensitive to this, insensitive to that, reductionist towards this, essentialist towards that. What I've seen from the early 2000s onwards is a tremendous loss of confidence among socialists in their own theory and in their own politics. If we're going to move forward with this, if there's going to be an actual revitalization, not of just the populist left, but of the project to which Jacobin is committed, which is the socialist left, you have to confidently embrace, once again, those commitments, those nostrums intellectually, which used to once define the socialist left. You have a theory, it's called Marxism. Whatever flaws it has is still the best theory in town. There is no alternative to it. If you see flaws, develop it, fix it. It's a research program. Figure out what's wrong with it and fix it, rather than being embarrassed about it. You have to be committed to universalism. There is no socialism without a universalist commitment against all oppression everywhere, even amongst dark-skinned people, even amongst the global South. You may exoticize it, you may want to tell cute stories about it, but they struggle for the exact same things that white Americans and white Europeans do. It's a matter of some shame that in the past 30 years, something called post-colonial theory was able to present itself as being a form of radicalism when all it did was revive 19th century racism. Embrace the universalism. Understand that you're materialists, which means that you figure out your program based on people's material interests, not on a vibe, not on values, but you're fighting for people's material interests and their material needs, for which there is no questioning the centrality of class. If you call yourself a leftist, a radical, a socialist, and you can't abide by the centrality of class politics, you're in the wrong room. There is no working class and socialist politics that doesn't prioritize class struggle. Because even for those social identities which you should be fighting around, gender and race, you have to make a choice. Are you going to be an anti-racist and fight against the challenges faced by the elites? Cedric Johnson was here. Cedric, are you here right now? This has been the hallmark of Cedric and Adolf Reed and other comrades. There is no such thing as anti-racism as such. There's the anti-racism of the rich and the anti-racism of the working class. And if you really want to improve the lives of working women and working men, you're going to have the leverage that class struggle gives you. There is no shunning the centrality of class if you're on the left. And finally, just say that our goal is socialism. We'll go through social democracy. It'll be a pit stop. But the goal has to be a democratic, liberal, universalizing socialism for everyone. These commitments were once the common sense of the left. They are today outliers. You have to actually still fight for them, argue for them. Until we place them at the center of our intellectual project, we are going to be hampered in advancing our political project. I'm optimistic. I think Mamdani is going to win. And one of the things he's already doing, which is quite extraordinary, is he's by and large backing up his commitments, not backing away from them. And he's calling himself a socialist. Sanders has done it. Now, for those of us who were in socialist organizations, it may not be a bad idea if we also did so. In this process, so the biggest challenge for us organizationally, politically, is to use these electoral victories to rebuild the left's connection to working people. Intellectually, our biggest challenge is to go back and work on our analytical framework that comes out of class analysis, for which the best theory is still Marxism. And hopefully, we'll all be here for Jacobin's 25th anniversary, some of us for its 50th anniversary, because there's no better and no more important organ for the left to advance this project than Jacobin. Thank you.
Wow, wasn't that great, Casey?
That was so good. I hadn't heard it the first time around, so that was my first.
I've listened to that a couple of times already. His podcast is Confronting Capitalism, and it's phenomenal. He had a great podcast about the development of capitalism, I just thought was just phenomenal. I like the dig as well, but I don't have 2 hours.
Yeah, preach.
You know?
No, that was cool. It sounded like he was speaking to an assembly. Where was that?
It was at some venue in, of course, Brooklyn, probably Bushwick somewhere, where it was the 15th anniversary, and I guess it was a celebration of Jacobin.
Oh, cool. All right. Heck
okay.
Yeah.
Let's go to a song. What do you say
let's
to that?
Let's do it. Yes.
All right.
Tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?
Don't you know it's gonna be
all right? All right. All right. You say you got a real solution. Well, you know, we'd all love to see the plan. You ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we all do what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait. All right. All right. All right. Well, you know, change your head. You tell me it's the institution. Well, you know, you better free your mind instead. But if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't gonna make it with anyone anyhow. All right, all right, all right.
Well, that is a song with a terrific scream. It begins with John Lennon's scream there. What do you think about that scream, Casey?
Classic.
I just think it's terrific. So,
not a fan of Lennon, but a fan of the scream.
Uh-huh. I'm a big fan of John Lennon, so we differ that way. There are a couple of decent screams in this world. Here's Fay Wray from King Kong.
Well, we should maybe say goodbye. We only have 3 minutes left.
I know, but I'm going to play these out.
So should we do our goodbye then?
Okay, let's do our goodbye. And then we'll go right to the outro.
Heck yeah. All right. 7 p.m. next month, Tuesday, December 2nd, is when you'll find us again. If you're interested in joining DSA, you may join at dsausa.org, where you will find many levels of membership to comport with your finances. Or you may find more at capitaldistrictdsa.org. Who wouldn't want to join the same organization as Zoran?
True enough. So there are two types of organizations for social change, ones that rely upon members' dues, and the others that rely upon donations. DSA is the dues-reliant type. We don't spend its time hustling for donations and sucking up to donors, but rather strictly depends upon winning people to its ranks.
With our ideas.
That's right.
But if you like our ideas and more, you should also go to wavefarm.org and become a monthly supporter of WGXC if you support independent radio.
Okay, we've got a couple of...
Come on, folks.
Come on, folks, yes. Okay, so Casey, just as the last few seconds, what would you like to hear? You could hear either How You Like Me Now or Mama Said Knock You Out to celebrate Zoran's victory.
Mama Said Knock You Out.
All right, here we go.